This weekend marks the 25th anniversary of the L.A. riots from the Rodney King verdict. 25 years, it's been that long. Some of my listeners weren't alive at that time or not of age, but that was a crucial time in this country, 92. A lot of different things were going on in that. Got to check out the documentary at a screener, L.A. 92. It's a dope documentary done by David Lindsay and TJ Martin, Ted, myself, and James from Lando Cal. We all got to sit down and talk to them as well after the showing of the movie. So this is a little bit in-depth interview with those brothers who did that dope documentary. As well, after that, make sure you tune in and log back into the show and stay subscribed, because we will be having a review of it. Me and Ted will be getting together for a review of LA 92. It comes on tonight, April the 30th, at 8, 9, I think it's 8 or 9 o'clock on National Geographic. So definitely go check that out. Interesting documentary, the way they put it together and decided to put this documentary together. So like I said, check out this interview with these brothers and make sure you check it out tonight at 8 o'clock, National Geographic channel. Tune back in a little bit later. We'll be doing a review of it as well.
It's a motherfucking nigga, that's why I'm sick of getting treated like a goddamn stepchild. Fuck a punk, cause I ain't him. You gotta deal with the 9-double-M. The day's coming that you all hate. Just think, if niggas decide to retaliate and try to keep me from running up, I never tell you to get down, it's all about coming up. So what they do, going down to AK? My shit wasn't registered any fucking way. So you better duck away, run and hide out. When I'm running real slow and the lights out, cause I'm about to fuck up the program. Shooting out the window of a drop top.
I'll go first so no one else is talking. Many artists, especially in St. Louis, since Mike Brown happened, have used art specifically as a form of activism. How important is it for you guys to use your art for activism or to portray something you believe in? And what's the best way you think you can deliver the intent of a project?
The last one, that's a big one.
Yeah. The intent of a project. I can definitely jump on the I don't... I would say our work is always speaking to things we believe in, but I think I can safely say we don't consider ourselves activists. And that is because I think we're trying, for the most part, I've always tried to make films that are exploring us as human beings, and we don't necessarily always have an agenda that we're trying to push. And that's not against that idea, it's just even our own personalities just aren't necessarily like that. So, but
what
we are always
thought of, though, is even though that's the case with us, but I think it would be perceived as activism.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're always trying to make something that is not, you know, we don't have like the document that has our like 5 steps that we want to put, you know, it's just like we're looking at trying to look at who we are as human beings and make work that speaks to that idea.
And like you said, it's not too politicized.
Yeah.
By the way, I feel like that engages and fosters a healthier conversation if you don't politicize it, right? I mean, that's, you turn on the news and that's all you see is just a series of debates back and forth where they're not even talking the same language. And for us, if we can create through our work where we're looking at you're humanizing the individuals, like we explicitly went out of our way to do our best to even humanize the cops. Like, we spent time with them. We showed them walking in the courtroom. We tried to not create caricatures out of them. And by doing so, that's almost more frightening, right? They're human. These are people with families and lives, and they were able to do these actions and then get away with it by another human who is saying, I know a criminal, I've seen one, et cetera, et cetera. So, like, you're humanizing all these faces, and that, to us, is infinitely more disheartening than the notion of, like, I've got an agenda as an activist to say this thing. I think it's more poignant to say, here, look, you know, we constructed the film so it's like a mirror. It's like, look at us, and then how do we engage from there, you know?
I have a question. You've been doing a few of these special screenings around the country. How has your reaction been to others' reactions when you do the after film talks, like how the crowd's different, like the vibe of each crowd, kind of what your personal experience with that is?
I mean, yeah, they've been. I mean, I've loved it. It's been it's extremely rewarding, only because we set out to make something that would foster, hopefully, foster conversation. So, just to see that happen, the you know, different crowds have been different, I think. That you can quote me on that. That's like that video of we're not here to answer. I'm trying. I can't think of anything. I can't think of like specifics. I'm always hesitant too to be like, this place was like that.
Right.
This place
was
like that. But it's been. I just as a whole, it's been rewarding because of the work, and then it's also been for myself. It's been humbling to just sit and listen to people express their experiences. Yeah. And you know, yeah, we sat and we worked on this film. Like, oh, you know, it was hard. I had to stay up late a lot. You know, like, it's humbling to hear somebody else speak their experience. You know.
Yeah, I think the thing that's, and this kind of goes about intent. The thing that's most exciting, specifically as we kind of through these word of mouth screenings, is to see the level of engagement after the screening, just across the board. And that, in terms of intent, that is more the intent, because we know that we are given a platform. We are in the fortunate position for someone to say, for a giant network to say, we trust your vision. Here's the money to make this thing, right? You can't deny that. But now you have a level of responsibility within that platform. And so for us, it's not to sway the narrative. It's not to say like, well, this is what we believe, so we're going to try to convince you to believe this too. But can we create a space for just to touch somebody in the right emotional way, so that then the conversation becomes between each other? So so in terms of intent, it's, you know, I'm humbled that it seems to be working in terms of engaging people in the way that we were hoping it would. And then in terms of, you know, from city to city, you know, I mean, biggest thing for me is we've talked about it. I'm sick of hearing myself talk. Yeah. I want to hear other people. I want to hear what their ideas are, because we always end up, you know, if it's just us and it's just getting a Q&A with us, it gets to this idea of like, well, what's, you know, they want to hear our opinions on solutions and how do you solve it. It's like, that's not my space, you know. I just want to create a thing for collectively we can actually, like, maybe we can figure out a solution from all these different voices and ideas and brilliant minds and all that stuff. So
if I could chime in, since you don't want to hear yourself.
Yeah.
my name is Winnie again, and I have an 11-year-old son. And I like what you said about it's not your space to create the solution, but I think sometimes certain things happen where the solution creates itself. There was a situation with my son at school around when Mike Brown was killed, and he came home one day and said, why did Mike Brown fight that officer over the gun? And I said, where did you hear that? Because you never heard me say that. I've never put him in the space where that was said in a conversation. And he said, well, my teacher, who was an older white woman, walked in the class and said, how do you all feel about Ferguson? At this time, my son was one of three black kids in the class. So that made me very uncomfortable. And I asked him three times, as a black woman, as a Christian woman, I said, I'm going to give this teacher the benefit of the doubt. Right. And I asked him three different times. The blogger in me recorded him every single time without him knowing. And he gave me the same answer, the same story, the same rundown, that she walked in the class and started this conversation with third graders. So I set up a meeting with the principal, and she got like hot, red in the face. The principal ended up putting her out. He demanded that all staff get diversity training because of this situation. And she later turned in her retirement notice. You know, I hate how it happened, but I think that was kind of like a solution that created itself because of an unfortunate act. But I just appreciate you all doing this film. I do have a question.
Thank you for sharing.
Because
my son, he has majority white friends. Right. And I remember having a dream once about, like, me and him were walking, and I could kind of hear the conversation in the distance of his white friends talking about protests. And then as soon as we got close, they looked at us, and then they stopped. And that kind of said to me, like, we don't talk to each other. Different races don't talk to each other. Mm-hmm. We talk to each other. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? But we don't. Mm-hmm. And it's upsetting.
Yeah.
So outside of just race, my blog is faith-based. I do things from a scriptural backing, but it's not just for Christians. It's for any faith background. Mm-hmm. I guess, what was your take on directing this? Did you consider churches as far as, like, what did they do in the time of the L.A. riots? And, you know, because I didn't really see that. But, like, personally, I've just, you know, been to church and pastors are like, well, this is the devil. You don't do that. And it's like, no, I'm fighting for my rights.
Right. So yeah. I see what you're saying, yeah.
I guess, like, what's your perspective on that as far as the church and activism? And
well, I mean, First AME Church.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that plays a crucial part in the over the days. It's where they're the ones who set up the, I mean, not only is it where everybody came for a rally after the verdicts. There's Cecil Murray was the reverend there. Brought all the community leaders. It's also, and again, you know, it's a title card. It's hard because we don't have somebody saying, like, this, this, and this. You know, it's a title card that informs you that that's where you are when the people that are displaced, that are where the Red Cross sets up, is at First AME. And so they played a vital role throughout the I mean, ultimately 6 days of the unrest. I think... And for us, it was important to highlight that because it was such an important part of it. If you go and talk to anybody who lived through that in 1992, they will talk about Reverend Murray, First AME. But in terms of, man, I don't know if I can answer
that. I think
it's
more, but I think that's, I don't, the research that we did, in you know, because there was other churches that opened up their doors for displaced people, but definitely First AME kind of was, just by sheer size and them... are being such a pillar in the community, people knew that they could kind of come there.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I think they created a space that didn't, where it wasn't about faith, it was just purely about humanity. And they opened their doors to, they opened their doors to Korean Americans, Latinos. You know, when you open it up, you know, when the family first walks in, you see a lot of, like, Latino immigrants that are there, simply because they either... needed shelter because their house got burnt down, or there was no more. They couldn't go shopping. That was a lot of the experience too. Is there was no grocery stores that were open.
Power within was out too. So
within the within walking distance, or else you had to like drive to like Santa Monica, you know, like on the west side of LA, which is predominantly a white community. So you know, and provided food, shelter, and that I think from. Again, I'm not the expert on this, but from our research, a lot of churches kind of it became more representative of what church has been in a lot of history of the world, which is here's a safe place, and that's at least what I notice. It's more about opening up your doors to becoming a safe place, and then you know from there they were really kind of being pillars of their community.
What was you all's impetus for doing this? I mean, a lot of documentaries you could have done. Why did you all decide to do this one? And what was the most shocking thing you all found from going through the archive footage and finding different things? What was something like that shocked you? Like, wow, this is what this. I didn't even know about this, or this is something that shocked me. Even.
Yeah. I mean, the impetus is it's you know there's a lot of reasons. I think one of the beyond the like. The 25th anniversary was coming. The producers of the film had already actually set the film up at National Geographic with no like idea necessarily what it would be. It would just be like making a documentary about it. And when we decided to come on board, one of our things that we said is we want to make it exclusively with archival material, no interviews. And I mean, you kind of spoke to that in the introduction as to why, but, you know, I think the Rodney King videotape, the beating of Rodney King, is, well, not the first, obviously, the first video of police brutality. It was the first that really, like, spread via the media and became kind of what, you know, a quote-unquote viral video. And when we... We're engaging on this. I mean, this is pre Philando Castile, and
We were cutting the film.
So, you know, but it was still obviously with with Eric Garner and all of the different, like, it was all this stuff. Was a very relevant topic, right? And so it felt like an opportunity to enter into a story that had resonance in right now, and be able to explore our past, to be able to see, like, what can that tell us about this time now.
The thing I would add is when they, you know, when they were kind of seeing if we were interested in directing the film, the producers, Jonathan Chin and Simon Chin, is they'd cut, like, a small little sizzle reel,
yeah,
you
to
know,
get
together.
It, to get the interest,
like,
for
hey,
it.
What do you think? And one of the pieces that they found a different version that's in the film is of Arthur Washington, the gentleman who's kind of wielding a hammer and saying, like, you know, I come from the ghetto too, this is wrong what you guys are doing. And, like, for us, that was really the moment that was like, I didn't recall that level of pure emotion that was captured. And I don't remember seeing that before. So, like, we saw it as an opportunity. How do you construct a piece of work that doesn't get in the way of that? That doesn't get in the way of those raw emotions? That doesn't have someone giving you an interview and saying, like, yo, it was crazy, and then there's this gentleman on the street, and then you cut to it. It's like, if you can get rid of that filter of, like, giving you the analysis of that, and just you as an audience arrive to that place, and you arrive to that place emotionally, hopefully, you know, that allows you to, again, just reframe it in a way that is less kind of less about debate or political debate, and more about, man, we got a lot of work to do, and, like, look at it through an empathetic lens, you know.
We got about 3-4 more minutes.
Was there any resistance from maybe judicial people, police, when you guys were starting to make the movie, or like, did you receive any type of threats or you know, trolls on social media?
I would have to be
because
more.
Now they're placing you in a box where you're with the people like ourselves that are standing for a cause for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's going to put a light over you guys. How do you guys feel about that? Is that a place that you are able to handle being considered now as an activist? Because you guys put raw footage in there that spoke to the lies that they tried to tell us in 92, that we see it all out there, like just the essence of it. Just it's an amazing piece of work. I'm still emotional from it. And just the experience as African-American men and women that we go through, you know, just seeing that on the screen, that's why a lot of the people were so emotional in their answers and their responses in there. Because, like the young lady said, it's not the structure that we're the structure, but it's the structure that was created post-slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Was created to keep the black people down or destroy us or kill us. So that's why the system is not working. And the only way to fix it would be the laws, like you were saying. But how can we fix the laws when, of course, the Electoral College is doing what they're doing, and Trump in the House, and he's crazy. So it's like, what do you do? Because we're at a point now, as a people, like, what do we do? We've marched, we protested, we burned down buildings, you know, and we're voting. But yet the vote still didn't count.
Right.
You know, so I know it's a lot I didn't say. My question was there resistance? And if so...
I think we're so... I mean, like, practically speaking, the LAPD was not very helpful in giving us stuff.
I'm sure.
But in other ways, they were. It was, you know, it was like the one guy at the archive there was like the most friendly guy, and he was just like, oh, look, what can I do? I'll go back. And then we'd like request all the radio transmissions that were from the time, and it was like we immediately get a thing back. It's like, no. So then we like try Freedom of Information, and like, no.
Yep.
And then we happened to go through. I'm not trying to make it sound like it was just TJ and I. We had, you know, other people, and one archive producer in particular, Ben, was just like determined to find these police radio stuff. And so he searched through something that was an archive that was at the University of Southern California. And it was, as he was reading, he's like, wait, this has all the materials they used to write the citywide report. So he goes there, gets them to bring the box of materials out, surfs through, and finds the tapes of that they had used to transcribe for the report, and then we were able to use those. So, like, but it was never like there was an issue you know, LAPD is like, it's not like it's not by any means perfect, but there has been, you know, there's been change that has happened.
They have a little bit more of a willingness to acknowledge, yeah, kind of, because you can't hide.
Yeah, you can't. I mean, you have, and yeah, I mean, just a very, very terrible history. The only way that LAPD could move forward was to acknowledge it.
Right.
So,
we didn't receive any, like, threats. Yeah. Or, like, any, like, there's no, like...
I think it'll be interesting, but, though, to see what, yeah, exactly, moving forward, like you said, like, you know, in, yeah, our, in terms of our own career, who knows? I don't know. I mean, I can't imagine we'd want to work with anybody that
would. Because this is something that Hollywood would have not approved of. So, like,
yeah,
you guys,
yeah, hang out. Look, you got to give credit to National Geographic. To, they're going to air this tomorrow night.
Yeah, because, yeah, my, like, thing is, I always just think about the white person, or how, right, they feel when, right, they're watching.
This is, yeah, that's the, so, as, you know, in terms of, like, us being kind of potentially at the center of it, and, like, how, or what is our perception going to be? I mean, I...
never thought about it.
Well, no, I grew, I'm not, I don't consider myself an activist. Probably some people would say I'm an activist. Yeah. Right. I guess my point is like, I grew up in Seattle, we marched a lot. You don't grow up in San Francisco or Seattle or Oakland and not have some sense, yeah, of, like, is, if you were not out marching doing something, there's something wrong with you. So, like, I grew up in that community, but in terms of the way in which we approach our work, you turn people off. You don't actually access the people that need to see it,
yeah,
by going with an activist lens.
Right.
So that's what, when Dan's,
yeah,
talking,
like,
about,
we are
that,
definitely, it's, yeah, as, yeah, people.
Yeah. But through our work, it's always trying to pull back that type of messaging so that people can actually sit
kinda
down and not be turned off.
Kind of neutral in a sense to give.
I'd say looking at, trying to humanize it.
Yes.
So you can call that neutral, or just saying, yeah.
Also,
yeah,
too, like, I mean, just to use my own personal example, my dad is, right, like, you know, lives outside of Chicago. We have wholly different political opinions. He voted for Trump. You know, he's got his, he says some shit that I'm just like, oh, fuck, you're so ignorant. But he's a good person at his heart, right? So, like, how do you reach somebody like that? Because that's where the change really,
yes,
will happen.
Yes.
So, you know, make him watching this film, and it's not, if like, to use the most, you know, I'm putting myself in my dad's mind, and it's like, like, if we had interviewed Jesse Jackson to talk about this, he would just be like, nope. And so then he's not, but he watched the film and had an emotional reaction, and was like, that's not right. So, like, the ability, and that's what we're always looking for, like, how do we just reach people in a way that it's, we're not trying to, it's like, yeah, exactly.
One more before I know we gotta get out of this,
yeah,
one is important.
And you
no, he's the one, he gave me some of the questions, so it's all good. Hip-hop culture, was that a purposeful thing not to present that in the movie, or not to bring that in, and how much that, because that was a lot of backdrop before the riots and after the riots, with how much hip-hop culture is talking about that this was going to happen, and those things, were that purposely, or was that just kind of...
There's a film that had been done specifically through the lens of the hip-hop.
Right, there was a couple years ago on MTV, right?
Yeah, VH1.
Yeah, VH1, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So, you know, I think for us it was, again, a big part of it was, how can we reframe this? And this actually will kind of answer both of them. I was just thinking of the dude. We went on the Roland Martin show in D.C., and we were part of, I mean, it was a short segment, we were part of this panel, but one of the panelists came up to us beforehand, you know, like, African-American dude, probably like in his mid-50s, and he was talking about how much he loved the film, and, you know, it really, like, resonated with him. He's like, I really love that you showed the Korean perspective, and I'm like, oh, yeah, cool. And then eventually, before we knew it, he starts talking about, you know, the rights to own guns, and he's a big NRA guy, and he's like, and then he starts, like, going deeper and deeper and deeper, and then he's like, yo, I'm like the alt-right, like, I am the anomaly. I'm the black dude who no one fucking thinks exists, that, you know. And he's, like, super conservative, but he loved the film.
Yeah.
And it enabled us, and we were, like, laughing about it and talking, and, like, it enabled us to have a conversation. Mm-hmm. When we got to the panel, he was the anomaly, but everyone on the panel resonated with the film.
Yeah.
So that's, you know... He said this explicitly, and then I heard someone else say it too after the screening in Los Angeles. I'm glad that you didn't do. I don't necessarily agree with this, but this was their perspective. I'm glad that I thought you were going to make another film that was explicitly through the lens of the African-American community, and it was explicitly, like, very Afrocentric, and was saying the same thing over and over. Now, I'm saying, like, okay, that's what you took away, but the fact that he felt, he had a feeling, an emotional, visceral reaction to it, meant that at least we created a pathway to have a conversation.
Okay.
So,
okay.
If we were to have, we're getting a little nuanced here, yeah. Not to say that, like, yo, if we included, like, facets of the hip-hop community and how integral it was to, you know, to the events themselves, and specifically, like, in terms of communication within the community, it's not to say that, like, that's distinctly just, like, that's the lens of the, Canadian South Central, but for us, it's like, let's remove all of those facets and just think of it as a symphony, and these are a lot, again, not avoiding what the crux and the nucleus of it, but here's the ripple effect of it. And that way, we don't get the people that are like, oh, just another one of these films, mm-hmm. you know?
Okay.
But
okay.
Instead, they're like, that was great. Now we can have a conversation.
Something for my godson Elijah and a little girl named Corinne. Some say the blacker the better, the sweeter the juice. I say the darker the flesh, hidden the deeper the roots. I give a holler to my sister's own welfare. Tupac kids, if don't nobody else care. And I know they like to beat you down a lot. When you come around the block, brothers clown a lot. Please don't cry, dry your eyes, never let up. Forgive, but don't forget, girl, keep your head up. And when he tells you you ain't nothing, don't believe him. And if you can't learn to love you, you should leave him. Cause sister, you don't need him. And I ain't trying to gas you up, I just call him how I see. You know what makes me unhappy?